Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with Jim McCormick in our Ames studio, professor of political science at Iowa State University. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Ben.
Welcome back to North of the Border, where you spent some time doing your academic work in Canada.
Well, thank you very much.
Also, welcome to Dennis Goldford in our Des Moines studio, professor and department chair of political science at Drake University. Dennis, always wonderful to have you on.
Thanks, gentlemen. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. And good afternoon to all of our listeners. Join our conversation today on any of the points. We've got quite a few, of course, enough for two or three hours. We only have one. I startled Jim there. He thought we were going to be on for two or three hours. No, we will do the same noon hour talk about politics on this Wednesday. Join us, 1-866-780-9100. Want to make sure later we'll talk about all that speculation about Oprah Winfrey running for president. Perhaps you'd like to share your thoughts in an email. Our email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Do you think she should run? Would she do well here in Iowa? Would you vote for her if you could? Why or why not? Email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. We'll open the phones for that a little bit later as well. So much to get to. Let's start off with this, well, unique, an unconventional president has an unconventional meeting, I guess. And let's talk about the meeting yesterday, a bipartisan meeting between President Trump and congressional leaders on Monday appeared to be a potential bipartisan effort to address DACA recipients. Trump says having Democrats involves, in his word, is absolutely vital, and that it should be what he calls a bill of love. Now, although the president says he still wants to build a wall and more border enforcement, he responded to a reporter's question about his position, saying he will trust what Congress comes up with.
I think my positions are going to be what the people in this room come up with. I am very much reliant on the people in this room. I know most of the people on both sides. I have a lot of respect for the people on both sides. And what I approve is going to be very much reliant on what the people in this room come to me with. I have great confidence in the people. If they come to me with things that I'm not in love with, I'm going to do it because I respect them.
Okay, so Dennis, let's start off with you. How unusual to have a bipartisan negotiation. I think 50 minutes is what they put the measurement at. 50 minutes, right before the press, bipartisan, not just a dog and pony show to show some handshakes and then say, okay, time for you to leave, media.
That is quite unusual because usually they are simply photo ops. But I think the White House must have thought in view of the headlines over the past week or 10 days that it's important to try to show Mr. Trump engaged and active and in negotiations with various people, even if it made some of the Republicans panic at some of the things he said. But it also showed that, in fact, President Trump has no particular policy interests or, as we've seen, not a lot of policy knowledge. He basically said, I'll sign whatever you put in front of me. And ironically, that's, in fact, what the Republicans in Congress had hoped he would do once he became president. They figured they could work with him as long as he kept himself busy and would simply sign whatever he sent up to them. Mm-hmm. But it shows that he has no particular policy interests of his own. He just wants to put his name on something that passes Congress the way he likes to put his name on buildings.
Mm. Interesting. One commentator pointed out this interesting thing. Their staffers, the congressional leaders had their staffers out in the hallway. The media was inside, so their staffers were in the dark about what happened until that meeting was over. Jim McCormick, what did you think of this?
Well, I thought it was quite remarkable that he said he would defer to Congress. That's not the kind of image that he wants to create about how he's in charge, you know, and he will be the final decision maker. So that was what was kind of startling to me. Now, whether that's actually the case or not, of course, there's always a problem with this president because he does change his positions quite regularly.
Right. Now, the president says that a comprehensive immigration reform bill might come after DACA is addressed. Jim, do you see this as a possible first step or two, if they are even taken on a road to that long sought after comprehensive immigration overhaul?
Well, I think what he really wants to get done is to get some commitment from the Democrats on the wall as part of the DACA trade-off here. And, you know, I think the larger-term immigration bill will take some time. I mean, you go back and look at 2006 and 2007 when the, you know, sort of Bush administration thought they had something really, really to go to and complete, and it really fell through. So I think that that's a bit of a pipe dream that they'll get a larger immigration bill here in the near term.
Mm-hmm. Dennis, what about the hardliner supporters of Donald Trump? He campaigned on the border wall, higher security, and this tough immigration policy. Could he alienate these people? People listening to this broadcast right now who supported Trump for that very reason.
Absolutely. I saw something as I was looking at some stories on the web before coming into the studio. I can't remember which commentator, conservative radio commentator it was, but he said something like, when you say Donald J. Trump, after yesterday, the J stands for Jeb, as in Jeb Bush. So, this could immediately, it has alarmed his hardline anti-immigration folks who put him in power precisely because they thought the country was becoming too multicultural, if you will. The question is, of course, if he does get them angry or upset, are they going to desert him, or are they going to figure he's the best thing they have going for them, even if he's not perfect? So they believe they've lost an ally with Mr. Bannon out of the White House, although they still have Steve Miller there. So, again, this is one of these we'll have to see situations.
Mm-hmm. So now that you raised Bannon out, yesterday this is the former White House chief strategist, Steve Bannon, stepping down as the executive chairman of Breitbart News. So he's lost two jobs in the last less than half a year after his criticism of Donald Trump, but also Donald Trump Jr. in that book, Fire and Fury by Michael Wolff, lost support of one of the Breitbart website's major investors, Rebecca Mercer. Did anybody tell you that money talks in American politics? I guess this is a case in point, isn't it, gentlemen?
It really is. I mean, I think that really Breitbart and getting rid of Bannon probably wanted to kind of shed all the bad publicity that he has wrought. And it'll be interesting to see if Bannon is back at all in supporting these candidates around the country. I rather doubt. I think his 15 minutes of fame has been achieved.
Mm-hmm. Will he regroup and return to influence, do you think, Dennis?
You never know with Donald Trump because, again,
talking about Bannon.
I know, but I'm saying with regard to getting back into favor with the Trump White House.
I see.
Jim was a Talleyrand. Some French diplomat famously said, France has no permanent friends or enemies. It has only permanent interests.
That's right. Yeah.
And Mr. Trump is the same way. And so if Bannon at some point down the road can become useful to him, he will bring him back. But the interesting question to me is that the Trump White House with regard to Bannon seems to want to have it both ways. On the one hand, the White House has argued that the book in question by Michael Wolff is pure fiction. If that's the case, then Bannon did not say the things he's alleged to have said, mm-hmm. and therefore, why would the White House send him to political Siberia? On the other hand, if they've sent him, as they have, to political Siberia, then they must really believe that the book itself is true or is accurate to a great degree. So they can't.
I can't imagine that they'd bring Bannon back, Dennis. I mean, I think that, you know, there's so much opposition to Bannon within the White House now. I mean, you know, maybe Stephen Miller's at his ally and so on, but I think overall, you know, that John Kelly would just nix that pretty quickly.
What about this question, gentlemen? Does this mean that Mitch McConnell, and he's had more than a few grins about what's happened in the last week, I'm sure, does this mean the majority leader and the mainstream GOP have won this battle, that Donald Trump is now firmly in that camp? What do you think, Dennis?
There's no permanent camp with Donald Trump. If you all and listeners are familiar with the game Risk.
Played it many times, endlessly,
right,
into the night.
World Conquest game. By the way, I've never lost at that game, so that should scare
you.
Oh,
that sounds like a challenge. I'll
but
take you up.
In any case, remember in Risk, it's an attempt at World Conquest, and you have allies and enemies, but you will turn on them on a dime.
Mm-hmm.
for the purpose of winning a particular country or ultimately winning the game. And I think that Mr. Trump, by all accounts, maybe he did this in his business world as well, but he certainly seems to see politics this way. It's simply about winning. And whatever he needs to win, he will do. And if something's going to cost him a win, he will do the opposite.
Dennis Goldford with us of Drake University, Jim McCormick of Iowa State University of Politics, Wednesday edition of River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Our email, I want to throw this in. Tomorrow night, Thursday night, Pints and Politics will be recorded live at CSPS in Cedar Rapids, another edition of that presented by the Gazette and Iowa Public Radio. I'll be there. Co-moderator Aaron Jordan will be at my side, along with James Lynch, Linda Waddington, Todd Dorman, and Adam Sullivan of the Gazette. Also a political scientist guest who's often on this program, Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa. If you'd like to register, it's free and open to the public, but like to get an idea of how many people are coming, you can register at this website, thegazette.com/pintsandpolitics.
Ben?
Yes, sir.
Could I have an equal opportunity for a plug?
Sure.
You know, I sent you an email, but you may not have gotten it. You know, Kevin Cooney and I have this thing called Wonks, W-O-N-K-S, that attempts to look at politics with a serious side, but also the lighter side of battle stories and fun things we've done, too, thus far. The next one will be this Monday.
Okay.
And it's at Noce in Des Moines, N-O-C-E. Doors open at 6. It starts at 7. We create a podcast out of it. There's no charge, and our topic this time will be politics and the press. And some of our guests will be Michael Gartner, Carol Hunter from The Register, Dave Buzik, KCCI. And there's no charge. We'd love to have an audience, so we'd like to have people come down and participate in that if they will.
Okay. Thank you, Dennis. Let's get back to immigration. Late yesterday also, we could talk all day about what just happened just yesterday, late yesterday, a federal judge in California issuing a nationwide injunction, the judge's injunction, ordering the Trump administration to restart a program that protects immigrants who were brought to the U.S. as children. It's the program known as DACA. They are children often called dreamers. Now, we remember Trump's decision late last year to end the DACA program, leading to a ferocious debate over nearly a million, I think 800,000 immigrants who could face deportation starting in March. Jim McCormick, your thoughts, implications on this latest injunction? I guess it is an injunction. It doesn't turn it back, but it makes the program continue for a while at least.
Yes, it does. And the response of the Trump administration was sort of this outrageous decision and attack upon the Court of Appeals and in California. What I think it does, frankly, is to make the it kind of pushes along getting this decision on DACA among legislators, because I'm not sure that they want to continue to have this continue to go through the courts like this. I think this actually may be a nudge, or maybe an important nudge, to get the Congress and the Trump administration to make some decision on DACA. And as you noted, it has to be done by March, when the president said he had put this order into effect, although this court decision lifts that, at least in the short term. The Trump administration said they're going to appeal. I don't know if they have done at this moment or not, but I would expect that they would appeal the decision.
How about this? It got obscured by a lot of the other news yesterday, but also in that meeting away from immigration, Donald Trump making a passionate case for congressional earmarks. Now, Dennis, Jim, you and I, we have talked about earmarks in years past. Now it seems to be the president is injecting some new momentum in an effort to restore this legislative practice. It's been 7 years without it. Earmarks, for those who need to be reminded, the custom of sort of individual lawmakers directing taxpayer funds to pet projects in their home states. Bridge to Nowhere in Alaska comes to mind. Perhaps you others, Dennis and Jim, have other ones that spring to mind. Now, Donald Trump said yesterday that Congress doesn't seem to work as well since we got rid of these earmarks, also known as pork, right? He said, quote, "You know, our system lends itself to getting things done. And I hear so much about earmarks, the old earmark system, how there was a great friendliness when you had earmarks. Dennis Goldford, after years of debate about getting rid of earmarks and then finally getting rid of what was called pork, will it come back? Will it be needed to grease the wheels of Congress?
Well, that's what it is. It greases the wheels. Now, a lot of people have seen it as unsavory. A lot of the Republicans and many Democrats have made the argument that, no, this is something untoward. It should not be done. But there was an article a few years ago, I think in The Atlantic, called In Defense of Corruption, suggesting, of course, that this was corrupt in a way, but arguing that it served a purpose. There was a great quick story from 1981 with the Ronald Reagan first budget. And there was a senator from Louisiana named John Brough, and he wasn't sure he was going to support the Reagan budget. And this was Senator Grassley's first year in the Senate, by the way. And all of a sudden, the Reagan administration found money for a particular bridge in Louisiana that Brough wanted. And people accused him of selling his vote. And he said, "My vote cannot be bought." Pause. But it can be rented. And in fact, that got his vote to pass this particular measure, because it doesn't matter what party you're in, Democratic Party, Republican Party, if you're a liberal or you're a conservative, all members of Congress love to take money back to their state or their district. And so it does help the legislative process. It certainly did get out of hand, which led to this movement to abolish it. But, you know, maybe they'll decide that, like prohibition, you went too far.
Mm, interesting. Let me get your comment on this. Repercussions of the newly passed, quickly passed law enacted now. We are in this country. It's taxpayers under a new tax law. The new tax law's limit on the state and local tax deduction is a threat, or is seen by a threat, to some high tax states, blue states, and their affluent taxpayers. So what's at issue is this new so-called SALT cap. That is the acronym that's referred to. Democratic leaders, and well, let's just listen to Andrew Cuomo, one of the governors of one of these states, of course, New York. Immediately after President Trump signed the bill, Cuomo told CNN News that he sees it as a political attack and redistribution. New York residents were able to prepay their 2018 taxes so they could take full advantage of the deduction before this law went into effect on January 1st. Cuomo says many people were lined up on a holiday weekend to do so.
Do you think they're going to forget? Do you think they don't understand what has happened here? They know exactly what has happened, and they're going to remember, because you're hurting them right in their pocketbook. Democracy ultimately works. And maybe it worked for the Senate, because they don't have any Democratic senators in these states, which is the epitome of political arrogance. Mm-hmm. But there are Republican congressmen. There's a Republican president who has to run in these states. And these people are not going to forget.
Okay, so the political repercussions, one thing, but Democratic leaders also finding sort of state-level workarounds, mechanisms being explored for taxpayers to fund state and local governments with charitable contributions and then use that as a credit against their tax liability. So, Jim, your thoughts on this? I don't know if you've read into this.
I have looked into it. And this idea of making kind of contributions to the state and calling them charitable contributions. I think, how much incentive will there be for people to do that? I mean, you have to really be a high income earner to do that, in terms of the sort of the general cynical view that many people have towards government and towards taxes generally. Mm-hmm. So I wonder how many people will really be affected. I think the other problem is whether this is really legal or not. At least some people that have commented on this have suggested that there, given that there's a one-to-one trade-off in terms of the kind of credit that you get on your taxes versus the contribution you make, that may in fact make it unconstitutional. I'm not sure of the underlying argument there, but nonetheless, this would negate the possibility of using these kind of charitable contributions. So I think what really has to be done is, how are people going to be affected by the lower tax rate? Although there's been some, you know, it's not a great deal of cut in the rates in the new tax bill. And how many people are really going to be affected by the $10,000 limit on their state and local taxes? I don't think that that's sort of a known factor yet. What's not been brought into the discussion, of course, was to raise the amount of standard deduction to $12,500, mm-hmm. and how much that will impact the people really concerned about their ability to reduce their state and local taxes.
Right, right. And this really helps those who do not itemize, who just do the simple form, right?
That's right. That's mm-hmm. exactly right. Yeah.
At the same time, I would say this raises the question once again, what happened to tax simplification and that famous imaginary simple single postcard?
Right.
You can see that it's just, if there's anything simpler than it was, we certainly don't know about it yet.
Let me get your view on this before we go to break here in a couple minutes. North Carolina's congressional map ruled unconstitutional by federal judges. The Trump administration, of course, complaining about that. Said that the court saying Republicans who drew it had been, quote, motivated by invidious, Dennis, you'll have to clue me in on that word, invidious partisan intent. It marks the first time a federal court has blocked a congressional map because of gerrymandering. So we have two other gerrymandering cases already before the Supreme Court. I guess North Carolina could join them if Republicans appeal this ruling. What would it mean to our politics for a Supreme Court ruling against gerrymandering when it's done along partisan lines? We already know it's against the Constitution when it's done along racial lines. Right, Dennis?
Yeah, that would cause an emergency overhaul of all of our congressional districts, as well as probably state and state-level districts, state representatives and state senators as well. The problem has always been, how do you know if the gerrymandering has been improper or even unconstitutional? And that's one of the main cases before the Supreme Court now, because the people who oppose certain kinds of gerrymandering say they have a mathematical formula that gives you objective criteria to tell whether there's been an improper and unconstitutional legislative redistricting or not. The opponents say that, no, that's no more objective than anything else. And the court's view is, if we don't have objective criteria, then we leave this to the political process.
Yeah, I think the
20
the
seconds. Go ahead.
I think the problem, too, is that, is this going to be one more area where the courts is going to decide the political process? And I think some people really object to that. I'd rather have it back, you know, sort of much more in terms of the democratic process with the public writ large.
All right. We have the minds and the analysis of Jim McCormick and Dennis Goldford. So glad about that. Jim of Iowa State University, Dennis of Drake University, and you on board as well on this Politics Wednesday edition. Plenty more to chew over when we come back. President Trump's radical departure from traditional U.S. diplomacy. Also, will the president have to testify under oath in the Russia investigations? New developments on that front this week. And we'll talk about the popularity or unpopularity of having a President Oprah, a president with one name. How about that? I'm Ben Kiefer. Back with more of River to River.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
We're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Wednesday. Reminder, Pints and Politics, recorded before a live audience at CSPS in Cedar Rapids, presented by the Gazette and Iowa Public Radio. Tomorrow night, free of charge, please come and have a pint if that's your thing and enjoy some discussion about politics. I'll be there along with co-host Aaron Jordan of the Gazette, also several Gazette columnists. You can register. It's free of charge, but please register if you plan on coming. The website for that, thegazette.com/pintsandpolitics. thegazette.com/pintsandpolitics. Jim McCormick, Dennis Goldford with us this hour. A little bit later, we'll talk about the speculation about Oprah running for president in 2020. Do you think she should run? Would she do well here in Iowa? Would you vote for her? Getting a lot of emails reaction to that from my call out the first half hour from Christian. Oprah is a great entertainer, but if Trump teaches us anything, it's that we need a sober, professional, politically experienced leader in the Oval Office. No O. In 18, I think he meant no O in 20. Lori, my personal point is that the media has gone overkill. I'm thinking pushing that Oprah wants to be president. I don't think she does. Can we just lay this to rest and let it go? We'll pick that up in a minute. Let's talk about the Russia investigation, gentlemen. Two points here, many points, two that we'll get to. The Senate Judiciary Committee's top Democrat, Senator Dianne Feinstein of California, releasing a transcript of an interview that the Fusion GPS founder Glenn Simpson gave. A little bit complicated. Pay attention here. Christopher Steele, he was hired by Fusion GPS. That is the former British intelligence officer who authored this infamous Russia dossier, the Steele dossier, sometimes it's called. And evidently, Steele wanted to show it to the FBI because he was concerned that the then presidential candidate Donald Trump was being blackmailed. Now, this transcript was released yesterday. Jim, how does this inform or enrich our understanding of what's happening with the Russia investigation?
Well, you know, a few days ago, Senator Grassley and another senator, Senator Graham, called upon the Department of Justice to sort of initiate an investigation of Mr. Steele in terms of misleading or lying to, I guess, to the committee here. And I think this is partly sort of the by the senator from California, Dianne Feinstein, to sort of correct the record a little bit that Steele acted, at least as what I've read about this, acted in terms of going to the FBI to because he had this suspicion that there was a national security breach here and that there was a possibility that candidate Trump was subject to blackmail. I don't know if this clears the timeline or not. I mean, that's what I think has to be thrashed out here. Exactly what was the timeline on these various actions by Mr. Steele?
So if I'm understanding you correctly, Feinstein's action to counter the Republican narrative of the shadow they've cast on this dossier, that it was a Democratic hit job.
I don't know if I call it a Democratic hit job. I mean, it was certainly an effort to try to clarify the record here in terms of what was going on with regard to the two Republican senators turning over this or sending this letter requesting this kind of investigation. So I think what they're trying to do is to straighten out the timeline. And I don't think that I certainly don't understand exactly what the timeline was. And they haven't sort of set that out in terms of the documentation yet.
Let's go to this other development in the Russia investigation. The Department of Justice Special Counsel Robert Mueller has notified the president's attorneys that he may want to interview the president as part of his investigation, Mueller's investigation of alleged collusion in the 2016 Trump campaign and with the Trump campaign in Russia and any related obstruction of justice. Let's listen to the president. On Saturday, he responded to questions from a reporter asking whether he would meet with special counsel Robert Mueller's team if he were asked. And listen to what he says. How do you interpret it? He appears to say yes in my mind.
Just so you understand, there's been no collusion. There's been no crime. And in theory, everybody tells me I'm not under investigation. Maybe Hillary is, I don't know, but I'm not. But there's been no collusion. There's been no crime. But we have been very open. We could have done it two ways. We could have been very closed, and it would have taken years. But, you know, it's sort of like when you've done nothing wrong, let's be open and get it over with. Because honestly, it's very, very bad for our country. It's making our country look foolish. And this is a country that I don't want looking foolish. And it's not going to look foolish as long as I'm here. So we've been very open, and we just want to get that over with.
Okay, so with the Justice Department announcement, they may be wanting to interview the president. Where does this signal? Where are we, Dennis, in this special counsel investigation? Does that signal we're closing in on the end?
Well, if in fact that's not just rumor, but in fact is something that we know definitively, then, you know, if you're working your way up the chain, you can't get much higher than the president. So that would suggest that if they're ready to talk to the president, they've worked their way up the various leads that form a chain that get there. And they'd want to hear what he had to say. And, of course, there's precedent from a president about a president giving testimony, as we saw in the case of Bill Clinton back in the Monica Lewinsky situation. So we have had a president deposed, not thrown out of office, but, I mean, under deposition and having testimony taken. So this would suggest that maybe the Mueller people are getting close to deciding what they want to present before the public.
Mm-hmm. And so this means that perhaps we're coming to the point where Mueller has all of his questions answered, with the exception of those questions that he thinks only the president can answer, Jim.
Yes, I think that's true. And, you know, going back to your original question, would the president testify under oath? I really think he has to testify under oath, particularly in light of all the criticism that was made that, you know, that Hillary Clinton was interviewed and apparently was not under oath. I think it would be a terrible action if the president did not agree to testify under oath. And that obviously poses some dangers for the administration. And I think the other thing that's happening is some of his lawyers are trying to narrow the agenda that the at least what I've read of what Mr. Mueller would ask the president.
Mm-hmm. He does have a record of being an experienced deposition witness. We know this from the president's past, right? Okay, size this up quickly. We've got to move on, but I really want to get to your opinions, both of your opinions, on these two questions in the Russia investigation, the question of collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia, and on the obstruction of justice thing. How do you size up each of the cases there from what we can tell from the outside? Of course, we have only a glimmer of what the Mueller team has. Dennis?
I wouldn't want to speculate on that, because all we have is a view from the outside with particular little hints about what might be going on. The president has said consistently there is no collusion, but that's the conclusion that the special counsel is attempting to validate or not. Obviously, he's trying to make his claim. And, you know, they always say about magicians, they proceed by sleight of hand. They distract your attention from what they're really doing by getting you to focus on something else. And the president, and saying, well, maybe Hillary's under investigation, and we've always been open, that distracts attention from what actually may be going on. Mm-hmm. But substantively, I couldn't hazard a guess as to where they are right now.
Are you going to be hazardous, Jim?
I guess my only conclusion would be that I haven't seen the evidence of collusion yet. The obstruction of justice charge is very intriguing, but there's all this kind of ongoing investigation of the Department of Justice, and apparently the Inspector General within the Department of Justice is also looking into the machinations there. So it really is a clouded web here to try to sort
exactly.
this thing out.
Okay. To be continued, for sure.
Yes.
let's talk a little bit about particularly your wheelhouse, Jim McCormick, foreign policy. Since we have a new year, the president, in just this new year, among many other messages in his tweets, he has urged protesters to overthrow the Iranian government. He's threatened to blow up North Korea and has called for cuts to the Palestinians. So Donald Trump, beginning in 2018, where he left off in 2017, in his tone, in his surprising moves. Comment, Jim, in terms of foreign policy, how far has Donald Trump strayed from traditional ways that American presidents express themselves and handle diplomacy? And what do leaders around the world think of this departure?
Well, I think the real problem is that all these tweets really exaggerate the direction of policy, because actually there's been, you know, some assessment that there's obviously been some change in policy, but there's also been a pulling back by his national security team. So I think the tweeting is really regrettable, because abroad, that's what people hear, because that's sort of newsworthy stuff, you know, the latest tweet, the sort of bombastic kind of statement. But yet, you know, the underlying policy that maybe his security team is trying to convey is sort of lost in the mix.
Mm-hmm.
Now, usually leaders abroad, in my own experience of being in Canada most recently, they understand the kind of the disjuncture between these kind of tweets and the actual policy guide. But I think the public at large and in foreign publics at large are much more attuned to these tweets. And I think that's the real danger, is that the substance of policy is lost by the exaggerated and hyperbolic kind of statements that the president makes in the tweets.
Right, right. Now, because how often does he follow through on what he says? And if he doesn't follow through with what he says,
sure, he loses all credibility. And I mean, and that's really the substance of the problem that the United States has. I mean, he came into office talking about getting rid of all of these alliance structures. That really hasn't happened. But the kind of language that he used, I'm sure scared or at least gave these many states great pause of what the United States was really about. And there has clearly been some pulling back from that. But this kind of disjuncture here is just not good policymaking, in my view.
The danger is that President Trump is becoming a kind of un-Roosevelt. If you remember the famous Teddy Roosevelt phrase, I believe it was talk softly and carry a big stick. The danger is that he seems to be talking loudly and carrying a small stick in the sense of not following through on various things.
Right. Jim, you mentioned your time in Canada. Short comment on that, please, because you've had that view for several months from Canada in a position, an academic position there from away from Iowa State. Trump has made many pronouncements early on, especially about trade with Canada, for instance. Is that still reverberating in the population?
Yes,
there?
I think certainly the Canadian polls show that there's been from a real attrition of respect for the United States and respect for the presidency, even though it still ranks the United States as obviously a good friend and a key trading partner. I think the other key thing that has happened and what's really struck me is that how the Canadian officials, particularly on the NAFTA negotiations, are entirely trying to work around the President Trump and his kind of proclamations here about NAFTA. I was struck by one datum that I was given that there's been 160 visits by Canadian officials to the United States over the past year, and probably more by now, to try to work the Congress, to work their friends in the lobbying community, really on the NAFTA issue. So there has been really an effort, and I suspect this has been replicated by other countries, that they're really trying to work around the president by using the Congress, using interest groups, lobbying friends, and so on. And so that was the kind of striking thing of how they're trying to handle a president who makes these kind of statements that seem sort of so far off of traditional policy.
Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, along with Dennis Goldford of Drake University. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River. The final few minutes before we talk a little bit about the Oprah speculation. Dennis, I want to turn to you because we had something historic happen this week in our capital where you are at Drake University. Kim Reynolds gave her first condition of the state address. Your reaction to that briefly?
Well, that, of course, is her first time on the stage by herself rather than standing very closely behind, but behind Terry Branstad. She did not mention him, if I recall correctly, from the address. And she laid out an agenda, and particularly with reference to an announcement today that she will appear at a pro-life rally tomorrow, that I would say reaffirms the thought that certainly Kim Reynolds is not a Robert Ray Republican. Now, Terry Branstad was not a Bob Ray Republican
Meaning
either.
Meaning what?
Sort of a centrist conservative moderate Republican that Bob Ray was known as being. Certainly fiscally conservative, socially moderate. I wouldn't say liberal, but socially moderate. Terry Branstad never was. But, there would be times, and of course, at partisan political events, you always throw red meat. But when I've heard Kim Reynolds give speeches at Republican events I've helped cover, she sounded at times as if she were trying to come across as Iowa's own version of Sarah Palin. And in terms of her particular agenda. And she made, you know, in the speech yesterday, right at the top, she made that pro-life appeal to reinforce herself with that particular Republican constituency, very strong constituency, very determined constituency here in Iowa. And several of the other things she said, talking about public funding, possibly for people who go to private school or home schools, that raises issues about taxpayer dollars going to support religious education again. So she's positioning herself in that speech, obviously dealing with budgetary questions, but positioning herself as a very distinctly conservative Republican, not, as I would say, a Bob Rae Republican.
Let's finish up with Oprah Winfrey. On Sunday night, Oprah was the recipient of the Golden Globe Cecil D. DeMille Award for Lifetime Achievement. She gave an acceptance speech, much talked about, covering issues of race and gender. To end the speech, she said that her work in television and film has been to say something about how men and women really behave. She says that despite all the problems, she sees that people are able to hope for a brighter future.
So I want all the girls watching here and now to know that a new day is on the horizon. And when that new day finally dawns, it will be because of a lot of magnificent women, many of whom are right here in this room tonight, and some pretty phenomenal men fighting hard to make sure that they become the leaders who take us to the time when nobody ever has to say, "Me too," again. Thank you.
Oprah Winfrey, part of her speech on Sunday night. We've asked for reaction from you, our listeners. Here's a little bit before we get to our guest, an email from Leslie. As a warm experience and role model-ish as Oprah is, her experiences in TV and film do not equate to presidential capability. Donald Trump's leap from questionable real estate manipulator and reality TV character to politics is a dangerous example for America, should not be repeated. Oprah does what she does with style and authority. Another black female with vast political experience, once elected, could tap Oprah as an advisor, though. Let's go to your reaction before we run out of time. Jim McCormick, Oprah in 2020?
Oh, I kind of doubt it. I mean, she certainly has name recognition, and she's, you know, comes across in a very empathetic way for a large audience. But I think what your comments from some of the listeners suggest that, you know, it might be in 2020 that we probably want somebody with a little bit more political experience and understanding the machinery of government. And so I think the other problem that Oprah would face is that presidential campaigns can be grueling, and they also bring up things that, you know, that can be very harsh. And I don't know if she would be ready for that.
Mm-hmm. Dennis?
I would make the argument very simply that despite American tradition and traditional American views to the contrary, when you're talking about being president, it is rocket science. That is, there's a certain knowledge and experience base you need to have to be a good president. President Trump lowered the bar in terms of what people think you need to qualify to run for president in the way of political knowledge and experience, but he's been struggling with his handicaps in that particular area. So as much as we want to think that anybody could be president, it is, to some degree, rocket science, and it's no more Oprah Winfrey than it would be any other celebrity.
A comment on Oprah concerning science from one of our listeners, an email from Deborah. Oprah is a successful celebrity and businesswoman, overcoming many obstacles in her life, but lacks the judgment and experience to be a U.S. president. Her embrace and active promotion of woo, particularly in alternative medicine, self-healing practices, natural gimmicks, and the snake oil salesman associated with them through her show and magazine is especially concerning in science communities, writes Deborah in an email.
For Democrats to embrace her would be to undermine the criticisms they've made about the Trump candidacy and presidency. Mm-hmm.
That's exactly the point that my guest, Carol Anderson, author of this book that's being much talked about, White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide, the historian from Emory University. I asked her at the end of our conversation yesterday about this. She is an African-American, highly thought of in the academic world. And she said no. She said, consistent with what she thought about Donald Trump, she says, I want a pilot who knows how to fly an airplane, I guess, is more or less paraphrasing what she said. Final words. We have a few seconds left. Anybody want to jump in with a thought, forward-looking thought about what's on your mind, Dennis?
The big thing is the question about possible government shutdown in a week or so. They've got to come to some decision to avoid that. Otherwise, I believe it's Friday or Saturday of next week. Technically, the government is out of money unless they pass the necessary resolution.
Oh, wow. Another government shutdown. That really doesn't make news anymore, does it, Dennis?
Oh, it's been mentioned. We I don't want to do that, but...
I'm saying that in a failed joke sort of way.
Well, we all have those experiences.
Jim McCormick, thanks for being with us. Dennis Goldford of Drake University, Jim McCormick of Iowa State University. Gentlemen, thanks for stepping into our studio today.
Thank you very
much.
Always
a pleasure.
All right. Remember, tomorrow night, Pints and Politics. We hope I'll see you there at CSPS in Cedar Rapids, presented by the Gazette and Iowa Public Radio. You can register online. It's free and open to the public. Please do register if you plan on coming. TheGazette.com/Pints and Politics is where you can make that registration. Tomorrow on the program, I'll talk with former Air Force intelligence analyst Evan Renfro. He's now on the faculty at UNI. We'll ask whether the Islamic State is really defeated. River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.